How will you disrupt yourself?
On today's show,
I just loved the challenge. Mm-hmm. I loved the work that you had to do to put in. I mean, the hours I spent on a basketball court dreaming yep. and visualizing myself. I love that time alone, and I love the preparation that it takes in yep. sports, and I love the competition.
Welcome back to the Disrupt Yourself podcast, where we provide strategies and advice on how to climb the S-curve of learning in your professional and personal life. Stepping back from who you are to slingshot into who you want to be. I'm Whitney Johnson. One thing before we start the show is if you find this podcast valuable, it would be lovely if you would share your favorite episode with one friend, family member, or colleague. We all have those moments. You finish reading or listening to something and think, my friend Rachel would love this. Well, if so, send her a note. We could buy a billboard in Times Square or 1,000 Facebook ads or even a Super Bowl commercial. Not really, but none would be as powerful as you sharing something valuable with a friend. Most podcasters, including me, will tell you it's the secret to their success. So thank you to everyone in our listening community who does this on a regular basis. Speaking of big plays and small details, this week's guest has had an illustrious career in the NBA. As a star player, a coach, advisor, and executive currently with the Utah Jazz. To say that sports are Danny Ainge's life is an understatement. As he told me in our conversation, it's the work, the preparation, the visualization, and competition that creates a meditative focus for him. This applies as a player and a coach. Sometimes this was all-consuming, and as a husband, father, and now grandfather, he came to a point where he had to take a step back. I loved talking with Danny about how basketball, a seemingly simple game, has been disrupted multiple times, even during his career. There are some great lessons in here that I've already started thinking about in my life and work. I'm sure you'll find some as well.
Where I'd like to start is to ask you about two or three crucible moments in your life, events that really shaped who you are.
So I would say that my first year in the NBA was a very difficult moment of my life because I was coming out of pro baseball. I made a big decision to leave there. I felt like I had a promising career in baseball, and I chose to go play for the Celtics. And I had very high expectations. I was college player of the year. I got a new big contract with the Celtics. I just had a lot of expectations, and they just didn't have the opportunity. I showed up to a really good team in the middle of the season, and there wasn't really enough reason that I had given the coaches to make any altering changes, any alterations into how the team was playing. That summer off season, I went to work and just really was determined on, you know, winning and prove to the coach that I would deserve to play. So the next year, the second day of training camp, I'm in the starting lineup. I get a phone call that night, and it's my father who's crying on the phone. And maybe you've heard my father cry twice in my life. I knew why he was calling, and he was calling to tell me that my mother had taken her own life. And that was a pretty big setback. And I went to the funeral. I went to do all the things I needed to do with my family for the next few days. And it was a very trying time, but, you know, getting and then, you know, like refocusing and trying to get back into basketball quick was challenging. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, my mother, knowing what my father was going to tell me, was, you know, when I was in high school, my two older brothers were out of the home now, and I knew how dark and depressed and sick that my mother was. And so it wasn't a surprise to me. It was just a sad time. Mm-hmm. That was a, you know, a changing moment for me. I had my oldest two children were born at that time. I think it was 22, maybe just turned 23. And it just gave me a different perspective on lots of things and just gave me more sympathy for people that were not in a good place. Gave me more reason to reach out and be kind, nice to everybody. I think I always was, but, you know, it was more of a focus. And my mother meant a lot to me, and that was just really hard to see her leave. And, you know, I didn't even really get that emotional at the funeral. it wasn't until that Christmas when I saw my kids and just go like, this is what she would have loved if she could have just hung in there.
That's a lot at the age of 22 years old. Your new father, your mother has taken her life. You loved your mother. You now have had, it sounds like, the most difficult year professionally, because up until that time, things had been fairly easy for you from a sports standpoint, and you'd had to work harder than you ever had in your life. Is that right?
Yeah. I remember the year before, a New York Post, Peter Vesey was a famous writer in New York at that time, and he wrote a headline when we came to play the Knicks, said, referred to me as Danny Ain't. Danny Ooh. Ain't getting it done.
Oh.
And I thought it was kind of funny, but at the same time, it was true. But that was the kind of year my first year was, too. So I think those 2 years were very challenging.
So they were crucible moments. They were challenging. Some people, those experiences would have just taken out. They didn't take you out. What happened for you?
I had a lot going on in my life. I had a lot of dreams that I still wanted to fulfill in my career. Mm-hmm. I was madly in love with my wife and my children. Mm-hmm. I was still very, very close to my father and my family, my brothers and sister. So I just had a lot to help me through difficult times, and nobody more than my wife and children.
Yeah, you had a lot to live for.
Yeah.
And like you said, your mother would have been proud to see you and your family and building this wonderful life together.
Yeah. So, you know, I grew up, my father was a very good athlete in the city of Eugene, Oregon, where I grew up. And then I had two brothers that were very good athletes. And I remember being 12, 13 or 14. And my mother just thought that, you know, my brothers weren't able to live their dreams, or my father, you know, tore his ACL in his freshman year of college football and was like a three sports star in Eugene as a kid. And she just, to her, sports was stress. I remember my brother had got death threats in high school football. He was a very good high school football player. And so she would, you know, I'd be sitting on the couch with her in a dark room, and she would be trying to tell me, like, are you sure you want to do sports? Like, I think, and, you know, it was like, I think that ship has sailed, Mom. I think sports is pretty much all I know and all I'm good
at. All you want to do.
I don't want to do anything else. Matter of fact, just, like, find another sport for me to play.
You know what's so funny about that is that so many children have to deal with the exact opposite of their parents projecting all their hopes and dreams on them of they want you to play sports. And you had your mother saying, are you sure you want to do this?
Exactly. No, I think that, you know, she had just, you know, she had been, they got married very young. They were in high school when they got married, late in their high school life. And so she went through all the pain and suffering with all three of them and the ups and downs that come with sports and the stresses. It wasn't a stress to me, though. It was nothing but joy.
What do you love about sports? Tell us a couple of moments. Describe them.
I remember when I was in the seventh grade, and like one of the greatest moments was my brother, my oldest brother, who was a hero of mine. He was a star athlete in Oregon. He was 4 years older, and he came to one of my games, and I was in the seventh grade. I was so excited, I wet my pants. And I like ran, I was shooting layups to warm up for the game. And I like ran into the locker room and, you know, like tried to do everything I could to cover it up and just flip my pants around. And like, you know, but I came out on the court, and of course my brother noticed it and was just like teasing me for days on end after that. But I just loved the challenge. Mm-hmm. I loved the work that you had to do to put in. I mean, the hours I spent on a basketball court, dreaming and visualizing myself being Jerry West or Pistol Pete Maravich. I love that time alone, and I love the preparation that it takes to sports, and I love the competition. I love the competing, whether it was track or baseball, basketball or football. I love that competition.
You are currently the CEO of the Utah Jazz. For people who don't know basketball well, what does that involve?
Yeah, I'm not sure of many CEOs I know in the NBA. So it was something that Ryan Smith had come up with. It wasn't a job I was looking to get. You know, I can say that about most of the jobs I've had, you know, in my post-playing career. But this one I truly wasn't seeking. Ryan and I are very good friends. He asked me many questions about the NBA as he was looking to purchased an NBA team over the last few years. Him and I became friends over a decade ago. So I knew him before he was a big shot. He was, you know, just trying to get me to want to get back into it when I had just left a job I really loved in Boston. And so I was coming out here to be next to my grandchildren and my family and to relax and play golf and just unwind a little and not really knowing what the next chapter of life was. He kept insisting that he needed me. And I said, I know you could use me, but it's not really what I have in mind. So we spent a lot of time over the next months just like, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. That's too much. That's what I just left. I don't want 16 and 18 hour days. And that's what that entails. Mm-hmm. You know, my biggest fear is getting sucked back into that because it really is tempting.
Because you love it, right?
And I also know what he wants me to be. Mm. And so I'm here to oversee the whole organization. I'm his eyes and ears. He trusts me to give him feedback on what's good and what's not good and who's doing a great job and things that we can do better in the organization.
So the way you describe it, part of what I hear is that you're coaching him.
In some ways, yeah, that's what it feels like. That's what it feels like it's been for a while, but it feels like I'm still doing that. I mean, Ryan has so many gifts, so many talents, and he doesn't have to be here every day. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he wants to be here every day. I think he wants to make a huger impact on the world than just running a basketball team. And plus, it's not his expertise. So he wanted somebody that he could talk to for 15 minutes every night and get a recap of the day. And does he need to, you know, come to the office and show up and fix things? Or can he continue to work in his office down in Provo and do what his great strengths are?
What has been one of your most counterintuitive hires and or trades? And why was it surprising to others, but not to you?
I served as a bishop in 2008 in Boston, Massachusetts. And in that responsibility, I had, you know, had meetings continuously through and with some of the greatest women around. And I often wondered after that time, like, why are there no women in the NBA? And there was one in San Antonio. Greg Popovich had a woman, Becky Hammon. I have no idea how good she was, but she was there. And I thought that was impressive. But my experience now as being a bishop and just, I mean, first of all, my wife could do a better job than me at my job. So I think that I'm just a big fan of women and there needs to be a woman's voice in our organization. So I went to hire two former players that were women. And it took me 3 years to get one of them. I wasn't just looking to hire any women.
Yeah.
And so I hired Allison Feaster, who played 18 years of professional basketball. She's a Harvard graduate and was an all Ivy League player for 4 years at Harvard. And I had known her through working in the NBA office and working in the G League.
What's the G League?
The G League is a developmental system, program for it. So it's a minor league for the NBA. And she was working in the front office of the G League. I did get a lot of negative feedback from that. And, you know, do women have a place? You know, what about locker rooms? Like these are men. This is a different game than the women's game. But anyway, I went ahead and did it. And we also hired a woman named Carol Lawson.
Before you go there, what did you hire her to do?
So I hired her to be in our basketball operations. So I hired Allison Feaster to be in our player development.
Okay.
So she was going to be on court and off court development of players. Mm-hmm. And then I hired Carol Lawson to be an assistant coach. And it turned out to be, you know, the best hires I'd ever made. I mean, both of them were just superstars. And Kara, when I hired her, she said, if I ever, you know, get the offer to be the Duke head basketball coach, I have to take it. But right now, the Boston Celtics are a dream come true for me. So she worked with us for 3/4 of a year and got the head coaching job at Duke. So it was a segue to get her. But what I saw in those two women and what I saw in my players was amazing. Like, I knew that a lot of players are raised by single mothers that are in the NBA, but I had no idea what the connection that these two women, they had a better connection than any of my men head coaches. But I also appreciated their perspective. Their perspectives were different than my men coaches who had been around my whole life.
How long did it take before the pushback stopped?
once they showed up, I mean, I still had friends, you know, around the league that, mm-hmm. you know, making fun of me, you know, not, I don't think seriously,
but they're just,
ribbing me about mm-hmm. it. I think that they don't think it's a bad idea as much as they make it seem. But if anybody was there, they would just go like, wow. And all of my people, like every person in the organization could see it and feel mm-hmm. it, could feel their impact immediately.
Okay. Just to clarify, you mentioned Bishop.
Bishop of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a ward congregation in Weston, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm. So responsible for a congregation of 250, 300 people.
Right.
Okay, excellent. So in our work, we use a model called the S-curve of learning, and it's a simple visual model to help people manage through change. All of our listeners are very familiar. But one of the major challenges that people have is when they get to the top of that S-curve, they know it's time for them to jump. It's time to do something different. But there's this huge psychological shift that has to take place to go from being a professional basketball player to not being one. How did you manage some of those major identity shifts that needed to take place for you? And what counsel and advice do you give people now as they're leaving the NBA, for example?
I'll start off by saying that I didn't really plan my life. I didn't like see myself as being a broadcaster, as being a head coach in the NBA, or being a general manager for that matter. I'm certainly not a CEO. All of those stories are kind of unique. And I think that I got my first job when I got traded from Boston to Sacramento. Mm-hmm. I was there on my own. My family, I had four kids at home in Wellesley, Massachusetts, going to school, finishing up school.
Oh.
And it's February, and so I got to wait till April to reunite. So they're in school, and I move and live in a residence inn in Sacramento, California, playing basketball, and I became very close with the 12th man on our team. His name was Michael Jackson, and Michael was a former player at Georgetown University, and we just hit it off. We became very good friends. I was traded the next year to the Portland Trail Blazers, and Michael was out of the NBA, and we really didn't keep in contact. So we fast forward to my playing days ending, and I'm trying to contemplate, am I going to go play in Greece? I got a big money offer to play in Greece. It's kind of intriguing. I have other opportunities in the NBA, and I get a phone call from Michael Jackson out of nowhere, and he is the person that is hiring the talent for TNT. And he offers me a job on the spot. He said, we're offering you, I want you to become the number one. I said, well, do I need to come and audition? Or he goes, no, it's your job. And I just took it. And, you know, I was going to make more money there than I would be playing in the NBA. I was in the NBA. I knew all the actors, the players, the coaches, the plays. I feel like it would have had a huge advantage. So I didn't really feel like I jumped off an S-curve, but I'm continuing having all the knowledge that I had in my NBA playing career is going to launch me into a new career of broadcasting. The next year, I was offered to become the head coach of the Phoenix Suns. And I feel like that relationship had grown. Jerry Colangelo was the owner of the Phoenix Suns. He had signed me 5 years earlier as a free agent, and I didn't have an agent, which is very unusual in the NBA. I did my own negotiating, and we negotiated a contract at midnight in about 10 minutes. And I had to have trust because he didn't have the wherewithal to give me the money that I was asking for. I needed to trust him. He needed to trust me that we had a deal, and he needed to have time to work the deal out. And we developed a relationship, and I played there for 3 years. And at the end of it, he wanted me to be his head coach. I did that for 4 years. In the fourth year, I had six kids at home, like I said, and it was too much to manage for me to try to be both. And so I feel like I left the team in a good place. We had a good backup coach. We had a really good team in place. And I went back into broadcasting because of my relationship with Michael. Again. So I did that for another few years when the Boston Celtics came calling, and they had new ownership that was going to buy the Boston Celtics, and they went to ask Red Auerbach, the legendary general manager of the Celtics, who should we hire as our general manager? And Red said, Danny Ainge. And so I hadn't talked with Red for 20 years. You know, so they listened to Red's perspective. They came to me on, and I said, no, I'm not ready to get back into the game. But by this time now, three of my kids were out of the house. So I only have three at home. My three youngest are still there. But I wasn't ready for that. And so they came back a second time and said, you know, we've gone to look at the people that you've recommended, and we want you. And I said, let me take this to my wife. And so we went, we thought about it. And eventually, on the third time, we actually accepted the job with them. But I never dreamed of being in these positions. It was just, but I didn't really feel, I felt like each jump from broadcasting to coaching, while I was in broadcasting, not only did I have the knowledge that I had learned as a player and, you know, been very close to my coaches, had great coaching throughout my career, but now in broadcasting, I meet with the coaches of all the other teams, get their game plans to prepare for each broadcast. And that taught me a lot and prepared me. And I think that I had a little bit of an edge going into being a head coach without any coaching experience whatsoever.
Yeah.
So even though I certainly learned a lot, I was much better in my second year, much better in my third year than I was as a rookie coach. I feel like, you know, I was preparing for those without really knowing it.
So I asked you about this identity question, but part of what I hear you saying is that from an S-curve perspective, you're a player, and then you have this opportunity to go into broadcasting, and you're able to, it's jumping to something new, but there's this vast store of experience that you're building on to do this new thing. And then you move up, and then you become a coach, and then you move up again. And so it's not, you're stepping back, but every time it's slingshotting forward, and you're building on what you already know.
Right. But at the same time, I don't have any idea what I'm getting into. I mean, I'm doing my first broadcast. I don't know what I'm doing. I have no idea. I've never done it before. So there's a lot to learn.
Yeah.
And same thing in coaching.
Right.
I mean, coaching more than anything. I mean, there are so many things that go into coaching. And coaching was the only part of my life where I didn't feel like I could balance my life.
Interesting.
I was obsessed.
It just consumed you.
It consumed my mind. I'd listen to some of my favorite talks and people trying to inspire my team. Mm-hmm. Like I wasn't inspiring my children, inspiring myself and my wife. It was like my team was everything. But one day I'm reading in the scriptures and it says you can't serve two masters. And like that's what I was trying to do. I could not be a good father and a good coach under my circumstances. I couldn't. I didn't feel like I could because there are any adjustments I could make to make it work. And I just didn't feel like I could.
So that was that the only job that you felt like you couldn't?
Yes. I felt like I could balance my life as a player. I could in my professional job in Boston. And yes, I think that every other part of my life I could.
Was it hard for you to make that decision of like, oh, I'm not balancing this? Like, how did you figure that out? Was that something that a conclusion you came to? Was it a conversation that you had with your wife? Like, how did you figure that out?
I think it was my own decision. Mm-hmm. And I think my family liked me being a coach. They liked going to the games. They liked my boys liked playing basketball with Jason Kidd and Rex Chapman in the gyms. They liked being ball boys on the bench.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a lot of perks that they got that they loved. In hindsight, you know, as I looked at it, I went, you know, like my family needs me at home was just an instinct and a feeling that I had. As it turned out, my family really didn't need me more as much as I needed them.
Ah.
And like I was missing out on all of the important things in life. Mm-hmm. And so that was a really good lesson. So when I got into Boston, you know, like that was always on my mind and I didn't want that to happen again.
Yeah.
I wanted to be involved in my children's lives a lot more because I felt like I was missing out on everything. When, you know, at the time I made the decision, it felt like my children could use me. Mm-hmm. My wife needs my help. But
you realized
they really didn't.
You needed it. You needed it.
I needed it more.
Yeah. I want to circle back to a comment that you made about Red Auerbach. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah.
You said you hadn't worked with him for 20 years. And he said, I want Danny Ainge. What did he say he saw in you?
Well, one thing he said, I know, because I asked him about this later. I think Wick Grosbeck and Steve Pagliuca were the two new owners coming into Boston. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, you know, why is Danny the guy that you want?
Yeah.
And Red says, he's the luckiest guy I know. So I asked him to clarify that one time. And he didn't really have a lot to say. And in clarification, I go, seriously, Red, I'm just lucky. That's why you're going to hire me.
You're like, what about all that discipline, all those years?
Yeah, what about all these other great characteristics you could have listed?
Lucky. He's our lucky charm. All right. So you have performed at the highest of levels throughout your entire career. What are one or two things that you do when you are off your game, when you've got this negative mindset going? How do you disrupt that and get back to where you need your head to be?
There's two things. I mean, I think of that as a player and as an executive. I think that they're similar in that I either go to work in focus and really concentrate on what's the task at hand. And that means that as a player, I go to the gym at midnight and there's nobody else in the gym and I'm visualizing and concentrating and focusing and preparing for all the different scenarios that I might face and just gaining confidence through hard work. And the other way is just get away. And so that would be the second thing I would do would be, I need to go play a round of golf, or I need to go on vacation with my wife, or I need to just get completely away, just get a break. And then, like, while I'm at work and I feel like things are getting too much and I'm not on my game, oftentimes I would just leave my office and go for a long walk and just get away with my own thoughts and listen to a podcast or listen to a good talk from somebody. But just try to get my mind off of it.
Mm-hmm. You've talked about visualization a few times. What does that look like for you? How do you visualize visualization?
It's a good question because, you know, I remember making fun of my college coach when I was at BYU. We were required to take naps.
Oh.
And so we would go into the nap room and there was like 14 beds.
Like in kindergarten. There.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And except we're like laying in beds and we all have headphones on and we're listening to Psycho-Cybernetics.
And Maxwell Maltz.
Yeah. And it was, you know, I used to tease my coach and I got in trouble often because I couldn't sit still. We had a game in 2 or 3 hours and I'd be out on the court jumping on the trampoline for, you know, where our mascot Cosmo used to do his dunks and I'd be dunking and my coach would see me. What are you doing? You're supposed to be sleeping. I made fun of him often for that. But I learned something in that. Like when I actually did try it and did try to visualize, I think there was some benefits. And so I spent most of my career, about 15 minutes before every game that I played, I would try to visualize myself with all the preparation I had done on my opponent and put myself visually through the game, the situations that I would be in that game. I think it's beneficial. I've tried to share that with players of this generation. Some have received it really well and really liked it, and some haven't been able to do it as well.
In the sport of basketball, who have been some of the great disruptors?
I think Red Auerbach was a disruptor, and I think that's why he's legendary. He was, you know, like nobody really liked him, all of his competitors. Mm-hmm. He played a fast tempo of basketball and was one of the first to really do it. Just get up and down the court as fast as you can, and he preached run, run, run. And the Celtics obviously had amazing success. Mm-hmm. I think Phil Jackson was a disruptor. I mean, he won 11 championships, and he did it with what's called the triangle offense. And in the triangle offense, it slows the game down a little bit, and everybody touches the ball, and it builds unity among the team and gets everybody involved in the offense. It was not an offense that Michael Jordan received well. And Michael was not happy about, and neither was Kobe Bryant when he was coached by Phil Jackson. They were not happy with triangle offense because it limited how much they could do individually. As the game slowed down and there was fewer possessions in the course of a game, but he won 11 championships with those great players. And
because it promoted cohesion.
Yes. And there's a lot of floor balance and including everybody on the team needed to do their role and their spot and be in the right place. It wasn't a star-driven offense. And I think he was a disruptor. And then I think of players that might have been disruptors. There's a lot of players that were just unique and different. Dennis Rodman was a disruptor in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But I think that You know, sports is fun that way because it's always changing. It's always evolving. Basketball is nowhere near the same today as it was 5 years ago, let alone 10, 15 years ago. The game is continually evolving. And so it takes disruptors to change. Mike D'Antoni was another coach recently who took a team of smaller players. The team in basketball has always been predicated on size of success. You know, if you have big quality players, but D'Antoni took small guys. He took Steve Nash in his 30s, in his mid-30s, and Steve was the first player in NBA history to have his best years in his 30s of his career. And I think that a lot of it had to do with Mike D'Antoni's system and play 7 seconds or faster basketball with smaller, more skilled, more athletic players.
You said earlier you want to win, you're highly competitive, and I'm wondering, how have you learned to walk the line between winning a game and helping people win, meaning not treating people as objects?
Yeah, I think that that is something that you just grow into, I think, through maturity as you get older and you realize that you don't win all the time and you still have to live with the people that you're playing with and playing against, and there will be another day to fight. But the competitive nature is, it's hard to get that out. I mean, I think that's why to this day, I'm 63 years old and I still love to play golf because like that's competitive. I can go play against really good players and feel like I have a chance, but knowing that I'm not going to win all the time. I think when you've been at it, playing and competing as long as I have, you know that you're going to lose. And so I think that just gives you maturity and understanding and how to deal with it. It's much, much easier, but it doesn't take away with how much you want to win.
Yeah.
I've always said that in sports, in professional sports, that you remember the losses much more than you remember the great wins.
Interesting.
Those losses, those big losses, those season-ending losses that prevent you from a championship or from getting you from an NCAA tournament, Final Four, or, like those are the losses that you remember. And those are very painful.
And humbling.
Yeah, sports will humble you, for sure.
Who are the stabilizers in your life?
I mean, for sure, my wife is my stabilizer and my children. We had children at a very young age, so my oldest daughter and my oldest son have been through almost my entire career. My oldest daughter was with us when we were playing pro baseball. And I feel like their experience with our life are just more people that, and you know, they feel very comfortable giving me the honest feedback that I mostly need. But they're my stabilizers. Yeah. You know, when I think of stabilizers, I think of like help me balance. And I think that they have been fantastic to have them involved so much in my life, and all my children for that matter. I mean, now even my youngest children have been so involved in my second half of my life and the second half of my career. And so, yeah, I get plenty of feedback.
It's funny that you say that. I find with children that our children, on the one hand, they see our underbelly. I mean, they see us at our absolute weakest. And so they will tell us, they are the ultimate truth tellers. But there's also no one on the planet that wants us to succeed more than our children do.
Right. Yeah, it's fun. I'm in the middle of a draft. My grandson is 14 years old, and I get a phone call right in the middle of the draft. And I look at my phone and I pick it up, like expecting only NBA calls. And I pick it up and I said, "Dre, what's up?" And he's saying, like, my grandchildren call me coach. And they say, "Coach, what are you doing? Like, why did you draft that guy? Why didn't you draft, you know, A, B, C, and D?" And I was like, "Dre, I think it's going to work out. I think it's going to be a good draft pick. We'll see. But I got to get back to the draft. Thanks for calling." And I'm glad you're like that excited about the draft. It's so fun. It's so fun having them all so excited about it and so into it and get their honest feedback. And I've always tried to do that at work. I've always tried to work with my employees the same way I work with my children and my grandchildren. Like, I want their honest feedback. I don't want them sucking up to their boss and always trying to just move up the ladder by agreeing with all my opinions. I love those that will have a good argument or will try to persuade me in a different path.
Is there something that you want to get better at right now that you're working on?
you know, listen, I've been married for 43 years and I still want to become a better husband. Mm. I have the greatest wife in the world and I want to be better. Mm. I want to be a better father and a better grandfather. I want to be better at my job, at mentoring players and be a better influence on people I come in contact with. So yeah, I remember I get a talk I heard from our prophet, President Hinckley, and he was 90 something years old. And at the end of a conference, a general conference, he said, I want to become a better husband, a better father, a better friend. He's the prophet. Like,
He's the best man on earth.
Yeah. And he wants to get better at everything that he does. I feel the same way. I just feel like I have bad days. I wish I were better. I wish I were more consistent, but I just wish I could be better for those people I love.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about two or three people that you admire and why. And I think I know one of them you're going to say, President Hinckley, but who are some people that you have just really, that you admire?
Yeah, of course, President Hinckley and President Nelson, of course. I admire my 19-year-old granddaughter who's serving in Poland right now on a mission, serving Ukraine immigrants and spreading the gospel the best she can under crazy circumstances, difficult circumstances for a missionary. I admire people that dedicate their lives to serving others. I admire a woman that I met in Honduras building homes and shelters, and she was there as a working in a nursery of lost children, basically, of, you know, unclaimed born children. People like Mother Teresa that just dedicate their lives to serving other people. I really admire all of them that do that, and I've been surrounded by many in my life.
But I also
admire Clayton Christensen.
Ah, let's talk about Clayton.
So Clayton was very good to me as a young professional in Boston. He was just a great influence. His books on missionary work later in his life, I had a chance to serve on the high council in my church, which put me over the responsibility of missionaries in my region. So Clayton was kind of the whole area, whole New England area missionary leader, on top of all of his other responsibilities at Harvard and his businesses.
Yeah.
But he was just so fun to work with. He was so inspiring. And he was such a great missionary in his life at everything he did. He was just so kind and so willing to lift you when you were down and trying to always be positive. I loved his positivity and his wife, Christine. They were very good mentors to us.
Do you have a favorite memory?
We're going to church one day. They're driving us in their small car, packed car with their kids. It's just chaos. A lot of chaos going on in the car. And, you know, I'm kind of frazzled. And Christine goes, Clayton, could you please get my bag out of the trunk? And I'm just thinking, like, seriously, right now? Like, there's traffic and the kids are going crazy. We're going to be home. And Clayton goes, oh, sure, Christine. I would be happy to do that. And pulls over the side of the road and gets out. And I went, oh, my gosh, that is an amazing human being.
Wow.
So I have had many Clayton and Christine moments and memories. And, my wife has reminded me a few times.
Honey, will you pull over to the side of the road and get my bag out of the car? Oh, that's a wonderful memory. One of the things that I always ask at the end of an interview is, what are some connections or observations, thoughts that you had as we were talking?
I think that when you asked me the question of the S-curve and moving throughout the different things in my career, you know, I had a lot of thoughts going on in my head of like what this S-curve is, because I really don't know. I'm very sorry that I don't know what your S-curve is.
You do not need to know.
But, and how, you know, throughout my life, you brought up the fact that from jumping to career, I was bringing up the fact that jumping from position to position that I actually had, but you had brought to my attention that I probably hadn't, or at least you put that thought in my head. Mm. There was a lot to learn in each one of those new positions, even though initially I said that It didn't seem like I was jumping from career to career.
So when I asked you the question of like identity shift and psychological change, and you're like, no, I just did this. And then when I said, well, you're jumping from one curve to the next, it sounds like as you were replaying it, you realized, oh, there actually was a lot.
They were huge differences. Yeah. Yes.
Interesting. But now it's been such a long time
right.
from the broadcasting. It's kind of pulled it all together and you see it as one big whole.
Yeah. And I mean, at the time I looked at it, was like, it's basketball. I know basketball. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there was so much to learn.
Yeah. I mean,
there's so much different between being a basketball player and a coach.
Yeah.
A broadcaster and a coach. Coaching is so complex. There's so much going on. You got all these players. You got all their agents, all their mothers, all their entourages, all their strength coaches. Uh-huh. And, I mean, coaching is so hard.
Yeah.
Very difficult.
Any final thoughts?
You know, most of my life I've spent, you use the words of stabilizers and disrupting. I think most of my life used a word balance. Mm-hmm. You know, I just want maybe a stabilizer is the training wheels that balance you. I learned at a very young age in life, my father would always preach to me balance. Mm. And I remember one day my father said to me, he said, you know, Danny, you need balance in your life. You know, sports is not all you can do. And there's many other things. I don't think he said sports. He said, but there's many other things that you need to improve on in your life. And I said, Dad, I am balanced. I play basketball, baseball, football, golf, and track. But I understood what he meant. And that's been a lifelong thing for me is mm-hmm. to try to remain to obtain that balance. I have tried to maintain that balance in my life. And like the one time that I couldn't was a very challenging time of life mm-hmm. in coaching. And to this day, I'm still sympathetic with coaches. And I always side with coaches. And I think that's why I've had success as an executive, because I understand how hard their job is. Mm-hmm. I don't want any part of that job. Mm-hmm. And I just want to give them encouragement and give them support, all that I can. And it's the same thing as a player. We talked about earlier in the interview when, as a young player, how hard that was to not play and to have all these expectations. We have a young player right now, Jared Butler, who was College Player of the Year, national champion, Baylor University, and he's not getting to play very much, and it's been really hard. And so we've had a lot of great talks, but I can actually feel his pain still mm-hmm. to this day mm-hmm. because of what I've experienced. And I've had many other players in my career that I've been able to sympathize with in those situations. But yeah, those challenging moments of life have brought great experience. And with that experience, I try to share that experience with others that are going through the same things.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to share three game-changing takeaways from my conversation with Danny. Number one, the games you have no chance of winning are still worth playing. Danny played basketball against Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, and more of the greatest NBA legends of all time. Did he outmaneuver them on the court? Not a chance. But he said those games were some of the most fun he's ever had. Think of how much there is to learn by just being in the presence of greatness. Don't shy away from it, even if you know you don't have a shot. Number two, diversity pays off in unexpected ways. We've covered this many times on the show, and I loved hearing Danny's stories about it. Despite the NBA being a men's league, he felt there was something missing and actively sought out the perspectives of women coaches. Despite the pushback, even in 2016, Danny says those were the best hires he's ever made and notes that the team had deeper connections and better performance with their leadership. The pushback quickly stopped once the new coaches got results. Number three. Sports, like life and business, is an evolution. I was fascinated by Danny's observations about how basketball has changed over the years. The game speeds up, it slows down. The triangle offense that Michael Jordan didn't like until it started winning championships. There will always be superstars on any team, but consistent winning requires cohesion, collaboration, and a deference to innovation, or you risk being left behind. For more on the business of basketball, you may want to listen to Scott O'Neill, former CEO of the Sixers, episode 219. And thank you to Scott for introducing me to Danny. If you want more on the importance of the feminine perspective in business, listen to C.V. Harquail, episode 130. And if you're curious about the evolution of the game of golf, listen to Steve Bullock, episode 237, who wrote Out of the Box Golf. Basically, it's Moneyball for golf. Thank you again to Danny Ainge for joining us. Thank you for listening and for sharing. Thank you to our producer, Matt Silverman, audio engineer and editor, Whitney Jobe, and production assistant, Stephanie Brummel. I'm Whitney Johnson, and this is Disrupt Yourself. Disrupt.